After the lesson is concluded this evening and after we've sung the invitation song, I'd like to take just a couple of minutes to make some personal remarks, but I'd rather not do that now, but rather get right into the lesson of this evening. Once upon a time, there was a woman who had nothing. She had no husband, she had no job, she had no money, she had no food, she had no extended family to meet her needs or take care of her, she had no prospects for help, and she had no hope. And in that state, her sons were about to be sold to creditors as slaves. That's how bad it had gotten. She was selling her children as slaves to pay the creditors so they wouldn't become homeless. Absolutely destitute of everything. So she was told about a man of God, and she went to that man of God and told him her troubles. She said, "I have nothing. I have no husband. He's dead. I have no extended family to bail me out. I have no job. I have no money. I have no food in my house. I have no prospects of help. And at this point, I have no hope but you." And the man of God said to her, "I know what your problem is. There's not enough emptiness in your life. So I want you to go home and I want you to gather up all the empty jars you can from your house and borrow from all your neighbors. Beg, borrow, take whatever you can get that's empty and bring it into your house. And when your house has enough emptiness in it, close the doors and the windows, and from the one little bottle of oil you said you have, begin filling all those jars with a bottle of oil." So she did. She sent her sons out to all the neighbors and asked for empty jars. I have no doubt that when those boys went to the homes, the neighbors thought, "Here they come. They're begging. We know how destitute they are. They're going to be asking for food, or they're going to be asking for help, and I don't want to give it to them." But when the boys said, "Do you have any empty jars?" "Oh yeah, empty. We got that. Could we borrow those?" "Empty jars? Empty jugs? Yeah. Yeah. That's what Mom said, get." And so she brought them all in. And they brought the jars into the house and they set them out all over the floor in the house. And when there was just enough emptiness and there was no more place for emptiness, God smiled. And she began pouring from her little jar of oil. Imagine how foolish she must have felt to take a little jar and start to transfer it to a big jug and then to realize it's still pouring. And when it got right up to the top of that jug, she said to the boys, "Bring me another one." And they moved that one and put another one. And it kept going. And from jar to jar to jar, they moved through that house. And they filled every jar. And when they were getting up to the very last one, and she said, "Bring me another jar." And they said, "Mom, we don't have any more. It's the last one." It went right to the top of the jar and it stopped. That was it. The man of God had told her, "Take the jars. Keep some for yourself, but sell all of it you want and pay the creditors and live off the money that you receive. And she had plenty left over to live off of. That story is found in the Bible in 2 Kings chapter 4. And I invite you to turn there because I want you to put your eyes on a story that sounds like a fairy tale. It sounds like the kind of story you would hear around a campfire or in the front of a library told by a storyteller to little children. What is the point of this story? 2 Kings chapter 4. A certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord. And the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves." And Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in your house?" And she said, "Your maidservant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil." A jar of oil. And then he said, "Go, borrow vessels at large for yourself from all your neighbors. Empty vessels. Do not get a few. And you shall go in and shut the door behind you and your sons and pour out into all these vessels, and you shall set aside what is full." So she went from him, shut the door behind her and her sons. They were bringing the vessels to her, and she poured. When the vessels were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another vessel." And he said to her, "There is not one vessel more." And the oil stopped. And then she came and told the man of God. And he said, "Go sell the oil and pay your debt. And you and your sons can live on the rest." I've read that story for years, and I wrestled with it. What is the point? Why didn't Elisha just say, "Go home, your cupboards are full"? Why didn't he just say, "There's plenty of groceries in your house, I just put them there"? Why didn't he say, "Go out into the woods and kill a bear and bring it back and skin it and sell the fur and keep the meat"? Why is this story here for us? I've entitled this lesson tonight, "Full of Nothing," because I think the key is the emptiness that this woman has and the greater emptiness the prophet calls her to. I think that's the key in this story. So I really only want to make two points to you tonight, just two. I want to try to show you from the scriptures a theme that seems to me to appear over and over again, or in keeping with the song, over and over and over and over again. The theme is this: God works best with nothing. God works best with nothing. Let's go, and we could start with the creation, Genesis chapter 1, but that's a given. I mean, he starts with nothing. He has nothing there, and from that he creates the world, and all the things come into existence. Out of nothing he brings those things. But I want to show you how he intentionally does that to create a mindset in us that understands why nothingness is important. John chapter 6. Let's begin here. But we're going to be all over our scriptures tonight. John chapter 6. The one miracle found in all four of the Gospels, the feeding of the 5,000. And I'm looking at verse 5. Jesus, lifting up his eyes and seeing that a large crowd was coming to him, said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these may eat?" Now stop there for a moment. Just think about this. If I were Philip, I think I would reply, "You're asking me? You're the Lord. You're the guy in charge here. You're asking me, where are we to buy bread so that these may eat?" And Philip then goes into calculations. It says he knew he was saying this to test him, for he himself knew what he was intending to do. And Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone to receive a little." I love that. Philip's great at calculating things like that. He works it out. He's looking at the people and he just makes a rough count like that. He's able to do that. I'm not able to do that. I'm terrible at those kinds of calculations of math. But he is able to do that. And he says, "We had 200 denarii, 200 days' wages. We couldn't give these people morsels to eat." He's already got it figured out. What is the point? Jesus is trying to get Philip and the apostles to understand they have nothing to offer as a solution in this problem. Zero. Zilch. Nada. They have nothing. And there is a similarity. I mean, I guess you could say, well, it's not nothing. They do have 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. I mean, they do have that they bring. But that's kind of like the little jar of oil. The widow, when she comes to Elisha, says, "You have anything in the house?" "Nothing." "Well, I do have one jar of oil," for whatever that's worth, one little jar. But for all practical purposes, it's nothing. I have often wondered about that little boy that was brought to the Lord. Do you ever think about that? I mean, we know how kids are. His mom has fixed him 5 little round cakes and 2 smoked fish, and that's all he's got for lunch today. I mean, that's not very much by anybody's standards, but it's enough for him. And then this man comes to him. Can you imagine? He comes to him, he says, "Son, do you have any, what do you got in the basket?" Opens it up. 5 little cakes and 2 fish. "Son, there are a lot of hungry people here. Would you mind sharing it?" Sharing is the operative word here. Can you imagine how much he thinks he's going to end up getting out of that? He ain't even going to get a fish eye after 5,000 people have dug into his lunch. And he brings it to Jesus. "Come, son." And then look what the Lord does with that. No calculations could have made that scene work. The point that Jesus is trying to make to the disciples is, I don't need resources of great amounts to do what I need to do. Had those disciples forgotten the wedding feast at Cana, where Jesus can take water and turn it into wine? Maybe Philip should have responded that way to the Lord. "Well, can we feed these people?" "Well, sure. You did at Cana, I remember, just a short while ago. If we can find water, we can get wine." Jesus doesn't need massive resources. Reminds me of the story about the preacher who got mistaken in his lesson. He said, "I wonder if any one of us could do what Jesus did in John chapter 6. Is there anybody here that could feed 5 people with 5,000 loaves of bread and 2,000 fish?" The guy raised his hand, said, "I can do that." And then the preacher realized what he had done, and he chafed under that. And the next week he came back and said, "Is there anybody could feed 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish? And he looked right at the guy and he said, "I can do that." And he said, how? He said, feed them the leftovers from last week. Jesus didn't need the leftovers. He didn't need huge amounts. He effectively does what he does with nothing. Now, there's a point to this, and I want you to stay with me on this. Go to Job chapter 26, verse 7. I want you to see that this is a theme that the Lord is hammering over and over again in the Scriptures. Job 26, verse 7. He stretches out the north over empty space and hangs the earth on nothing. What? Hangs the earth on nothing. What's he trying to say? God, by his power, can do with nothing what nobody could do with everything. We couldn't build a big enough hook or net to hold the world in place. God specifically says, I don't need anything. I want nothing to hang this earth over. He is touting his power when nothing is there to work with. Let me show you that again. Go to Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6. I'm looking at verses 21 and 22. This is Luke's version of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus essentially says the same thing in a different way in Matthew chapter 5. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you shall be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when men hate you and ostracize you, insult you, and scorn your name as evil for the sake of the Son of Man. Be glad in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. Listen to what Jesus says. Hunger is deprivation. It's a form of deprivation. You're blessed if you have nothing to eat, for you shall be filled later. I'll do that if you're hungry. I will give you laughter if you weep. What is weeping? Typically, we weep when we're deprived. I know there is a kind of weeping for joy or pride, but that's not what's being discussed here. It is presented in opposition to the satisfaction of laughing. This is the dissatisfied weeping. Why do we weep? We weep because we've lost something. A child cries because something is lost. Maybe a pet. Maybe a favorite toy. Or a young man or woman cries because they've lost their loved one in a romantic relationship. Or we weep at a grave because we've lost. We are empty. We have nothing. We are empty. And God says, you're blessed because I can fill that. I can do something with that. I'll turn your weeping to laughter. I'll turn your hunger to fullness. I will turn the scorn and insults and the ostracization of society when you are isolated and lonely and hurting. I will turn that into a great reward that you will have in heaven. God says, give me nothing and I will fill that. I'll make something good come from that. Now, let me just quickly run through some stories in the Bible you're familiar with and show you how this theme keeps coming up. When is it that the prodigal son is blessed in the story of the prodigal son? It is when he has nothing. When he is sitting in the pig pen and he's looking at what the pigs are eating and thinking, that looks pretty good right now. Does he have friends? No. Does he have money? No. Does he have health? No. Does he have a future? No. Does he have hope? No. What does he say? I am sitting here empty, hungry, hopeless, and my father's house is filled with servants who have everything. I will get up and go to my father. It's only when he recognizes there is nothing he has resource-wise in and of himself that can save his life. I think about the Samaritan woman who comes to Jesus at the well. And she has brought with her an empty pot. She is listening to Jesus talk with an empty pot on her shoulder. Symbolically, it represents where she is. Because she has been married multiple times and she's living with a man she's not married to and she has no real hope. And she's talking to the one who recognizes her nothingness and will present her with everything she's needed. Come, she says, meet a man who has told me everything about myself. Elijah hears the voice of God and the message from God in a way he has never heard it before. When? When he is crying out to God, I alone am left, and there is no one in all of Israel to stand with me. Take my life too. It is the man who is empty who hears God commission him to his great work. Want to see it again? John chapter 21. When the disciples are out there in that boat fishing and they hear a voice calling to them from the shore, brothers, what have you caught? You remember what their answer is? We have fished all night and caught nothing. Nothing. Do you think that miracle would have happened the way it did if they had said, we got the biggest haul we've ever had in our lives? That might have then been a miracle in reverse. Jesus might have said, fish, out of the boat, back into the water. But as a result of their answer, we have fished all night and caught nothing, Jesus says, let your nets down on the other side. And they pull up a catch they cannot even get into the boat. Now let me show you that in reverse one more time. Stay with me one more time in reverse. I want you to think about a man who came to Jesus who gave all the right answers. Threw himself at the feet of the Lord. And was told, keep the commandments. And he said, I've done that. He's a righteous young man. Jesus doesn't argue with him about that. He doesn't say, you have not. He says, well, let me tell you what you do have to do. You're rich. There's not, if I may paraphrase, there's not enough nothingness in you. Go sell all you have, and when you're empty, come back and follow me. Jesus can't do anything for that young man. He watches him go away sorrowful. Why? Because he's not willing to reach that level of nothingness. What does that mean to us? Is the point, Ralph, is the point we need to get rid of everything we have, turn it all over to charitable organizations? Is it that we can't own anything? No, I don't think it's that. Because Jesus doesn't say that to every person that follows him. But I will say this. Listen carefully. Every disciple of Jesus must come to him with emptiness in heart. You can't come to Jesus without a recognition of emptiness and inability to be what you need to be and want to be in and of yourself. If you have that self-sufficiency, you will go away like the rich young ruler went away. Now, that emptiness will differ with different ones of us. I don't mean to say it will differ that one for one it'll be physical possessions and for another it'll be relationships, but I do mean to varying degrees of the feeling of emptiness that must be ours, Jesus will fill what is lacking in us. And we fear being empty, particularly in our culture. Our culture doesn't like emptiness. We really want to be self-sufficient. And I'm not even talking about the people who are storing up food for the apocalypse that is to come on this earth. I'm not even referring to that. We just don't like being insufficient. And yet, you know the answer to this question. You know the answer to this. When did Israel most often leave God? Was it when they were poverty-stricken, destitute, famine-ridden people? Or was it when they were full and satisfied and fat with the prosperity of their lives? In which one of those Israels, and they were both, which one of those left God? And you know the answer. More often than not, it was this group. It was the full group. It was the prosperous group. It was the comfortable group. Why? Why is that? Because they didn't need God. They didn't recognize what he had done for them. And you can't pour anything into a full glass. And they felt they were full. And they didn't recognize it. But if they had poured out what they had and come to the Lord empty, like this side we talked about, recognizing their physical poverty, their physical destitution, their physical frailties, and translated that into their spiritual frailties and said, God, we need you. Then they could turn back to God. And he could fill their lives. Luke chapter 12, verse 15. Luke 12, verse 15. He said to them, beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. Even when you have an abundance is not where your confidence should lie. That is not what your life should consist of. You can be rich and empty if you have the right mentality about your riches. But for many of us, we're not willing to do that. If God is not working in us, with us, through us, maybe it's because our hands are so full of the things we're grasping that he can't put anything else into them. There's not enough nothingness here for him to fill it. We've overloaded our hands. And God gives us, I think, this story about this woman to say, let me show you how far down into nothingness you can go. And the deeper you get into the nothingness, isn't it odd? He tells her, bring empty jars. He wants her to see great emptiness around her so that he can fill it. And the more emptiness she has, the more filling he can do. And I believe that's true for us, folks. I believe a person who can sing with absolute conviction, I need thee every hour I need thee, is going to be blessed to a greater degree than the person who sings it without conviction or doesn't sing it at all. How much emptiness is there in your life? How much emptiness? Because apart from God, my jar will always remain hollow. If God's not in it, I just got empty jars. And even if I pour everything I've got into them, I'm still empty. But I don't even recognize it, and God cannot fill it. Because I poured all my hobbies and talents and possessions and prides and relationships into my jars, and there's no place left for the oil of God's goodness and grace to be poured into it. How empty are you, folks? Pray that God will send a Grand Canyon into your life, big enough for Him to fill. Because the more emptiness you have, the greater God's filling can be. But without that, my wallet will always be flat. My life will always be unfulfilled. My hopes will always be incomplete. And my nets will always be empty. Last passage, and we'll conclude. Revelation chapter 3, verse 17. These words really speak to this issue. Revelation chapter 3, verse 17. Because you say, I am rich and have become wealthy and have need of nothing, and you do not know that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. Now, I want you to look at a phrase here that's really interesting to me, because it's almost a double meaning. You say, I am rich, I have become wealthy, I have need of nothing. That's true. They had a need for nothing, but they didn't recognize it. Now, that's not what the text is meaning. You may say, oh, I didn't know that's what it meant. That's not what the text means. The text means, I don't have a need for anything in my life. It's a kind of a formal way of saying that. I need nothing. But in reality, they did. They needed nothing. God says, can I help you? No, thanks. I need nothing. When we say it because we think we have everything, we deny God the ability to fill us. In fact, we do need nothing. It's not easy to achieve that state when all in our culture around us are telling us success depends on what you have and what you make of yourself. God says, give me nothing. In Psalm chapter 81, verse 10, God says, open your mouth wide and I'll fill it. We used to play a game with young people, sometimes at camps and sometimes at gatherings we'd have. The game is called Chubby Bunny. You take marshmallows and you stick one in your mouth and pronounce the words Chubby Bunny, and the other person does the same thing. You stick a second one in and a third one in, and your mouth is getting bigger and bigger, but you reach a point where you can't put anything in it. You open your mouth wide, but you can't put another marshmallow in it because it is full of what you have. God says, open your mouth wide, but give me an empty mouth, and I'll fill it. Empty. Full of nothing. That's where God wants us. So we sing the song sometimes, just as I am without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me. You want to come to the Lord? You come with nothing. Come with the emptiness of your life. Come with the shattered hopes, the bitterness, the broken dreams. Come to Him with empty pots and jars and let Him fill it. That's what God does best. Because God works with nothing best. Are you that? Will you come to Him tonight? Bring Him all the things that are wrong. Dump them out before Him and let Him fill your life. Because He can do that. This Lamb of God who calls you to come. You do that now while we stand and sing, "Come."